Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hey, good to see you, Brandon. How you doing?
Never better.
Terrific.
Thanks for joining today. I'm really grateful for you being on.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Everything you've done in your career, believe it or not, has completely changed my life. And I'm probably here in Half Moon Bay in this recording studio because of things that you started.
Well, you're very kind. I appreciate the role you played at AOL almost, I guess, 2 decades ago.
I did. It was 2 decades ago. I want to take listeners, if it's okay with you, through a little bit of a journey. You've actually left nuggets throughout your career. Even in your first book, The Third Wave, you mentioned Rise of the Rest. And I had notes from that book, but I think it was in the last chapters you actually say something, which I think you were setting up. And I believe, having read your story, worked at your company, that you've always had some sort of vision. And I wonder how it happened. Most people probably think that AOL's quote unquote start happened in 1983 when you joined CVC from Pizza Hut. But I actually believe, and I'm curious your thoughts, that it started in 1980 when you tried to go to business school and wrote a paper about the future of which is very hard to argue has come true.
Yeah, that's true. I was in college in the late 70s, and as part of that, learned in probably 78, 79, certainly 80, about this new development of this new set of technologies that we now think of as the internet. At the time, there was tests of things like video text and teletext and something called Minitel in France and Prestel in the UK. And so there's some early pioneering tests in the late 70s. And I remember reading a book by Alvin Toffler in 1980 called The Third Wave, where he's predicting essentially this electronic frontier that was going to come. And I just was sure that was going to happen. So I really was eager to be part of making it happen. But you're right, when I graduated in 1980, since there really at the time weren't internet companies to go to, and certainly venture capitalists were not backing 21-year-old kids with crazy ideas. So that's why I went and worked for some big companies for a few years, Procter & Gamble, then PepsiCo, before then finally, you know, getting into a startup in the Northern Virginia, D.C. region that then led to starting AOL in 1985. So it was I had an interest much earlier, but it just took me a few years to figure out how to jump in.
Well, you definitely did that. And one of the things, and I had mentioned to you before we were on the air, that I really liked the myth bust, because leading to Rise of the Rest and these entrepreneurs basically doing companies in non-developed ecosystems, so to speak, is really hard. I started my first company on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, of all places, which probably like the least place you would start a company in Eastern Maryland. But the idea that AOL started in 1985 and it really took a decade to figure out, and I hate to use this, Steve, but product market fit, people talk about it, but basically just figure out the problem or let the time come to where your solution fits that moment. And I mean, there's so many times when AOL could have died. I actually remember a guy by the name of John Burton, who you might remember from Updata Capital, saying, and I worked for them after I left AOL, but they said, yeah, Steve and some guys were building some company behind the car dealership and we really missed the opportunity. But it really took a long time for that idea of AOL to develop. And it's a long story, but could you talk a little bit about that idea that nothing happens overnight and it's going to take a minute?
Yeah, there occasionally sort of this overnight success. Maybe Facebook is an example of that. So it starts in a dorm room, a year later it's a global phenomenon. But that's really, really rare. I think our experience with AOL, where it was kind of working, kind of slogging away for a decade before finally it took off, is sort of more common. And some of it is certainly product market fit, but I also, as I think back of that, there are just a bunch of things that had to kick in. And it just took time. When we got started in 1985, only 3% of people were online. Those 3% were only online 1 hour a week. And part of the reason for that is most people didn't have personal computers, so couldn't connect. Most of the personal computers back then did not have modems, communications capability. If you did have a computer and you did have a modem, it was hard to get connected. The communication software at the time was pretty complicated. And if you were able to get connected, it was pretty expensive, sometimes $10 an hour to be connected, which was kind of a problem. And there wasn't that much to do and not many people to talk to because it was through the early days. So it just was, you know, some of it was creating a product, which ultimately led to the success of AOL that was easy to use and fun and affordable. But some of that I think we had earlier, but the market just took some time to develop. I mean, how do you get the PCs so they are broadly adopted? How do you get the PC manufacturers to build a modem in so it was central, kind of a central part of what you bought as opposed to being viewed as sort of a peripheral device? How do you get, you know, the cost of communications down? How do you get the value of being connected up? It just took time for those things to, you know, to develop. So that was one of the lessons I learned. And the other lesson it ties in with the rise of the rest is, you know, it was harder to get started in Northern Virginia. It was harder to raise, you know, venture capital because we were there. All our venture capital came from other places. None of it came from, you know, the greater Washington, D.C. region. It was hard to get people to leave big companies to join a little company because it seemed, you know, pretty risky. It was hard to get people to pay attention, including local media, Washington Post, things like that. They just thought the thing was kind of not, you know, not that big a deal. So I think having had the experience of building something that took some time to develop and also had the experience of building someplace outside of the normal tech hubs, I think gave me a perspective and I think some empathy for the entrepreneurs in these rise of the rest cities, which is partly why I've been, you know, focused on that and sort of championing that for most of the last decade.
During that part when in those early years of AOL, you actually, and you talked about it a little bit in your first book, but you really had to put your ego aside because there was a time when you actually were asked to leave as CEO. Jim McKinsey came on board and I guess assured you in some, whatever that means at that moment, that you would be back. And for entrepreneurs who are listening, what inside you brings you to be able to do that, to see the broader vision at that moment and quite candidly not quit or, you know, do say, hey, look, I've had enough of you all?
The backstory there is AOL started, as I said, 1985. There were three co-founders, Jim Kimsey, Mark Zaroff, and I started as sort of the executive vice president. Mark was in charge of the technology. Jim was the founding CEO and brought sort of more experience and business savvy. He was 20 years older than I was, for example. I was my, kind of late 20s at the time. And over a few years, my position kept expanding. And eventually, I think it was probably in 1990, 91, something like that, I became CEO of the company. But then we would decide to go public, and it was 1992, it was first internet company to go public. And, you know, the investors on the board, the venture capitalists, thought that it might be a hard sell to get, you know, the Wall Street to believe in the idea of the internet and believe in this, you know, company, America Online. And harder still if there was a 30-year-old CEO, not a 50-year-old CEO. And yeah, I know it sounds crazy now, but that was the three decades ago that there weren't a lot of companies going public with 30-year-old CEOs. And so they viewed it as, you know, a lot of risk associated with going public and more risk if it was a kid, you know, leading the charge. And so that did lead to the board deciding that I should step aside as CEO. Jim Kimsey should become CEO again until we got public, and then, you know, they would rethink it. So that's what happened. And to your point, it was frustrating. And I did think about quitting, and a bunch of people working for me, you know, also threatened to quit, just a little bit of a protest. And I took a step back and it said, look, I don't agree with the decision, but I do believe in the company and do believe in the vision of the company. So I'll kind of suck it up and, you know, kind of essentially take on a different role. And then we did go public. And about 6 months after that, I did become, you know, CEO again. So at the time, it was frustrating and for sure disappointing, but decided to focus on building the company, focus on going public. And eventually, not too long after we went public, I did become CEO again, then stayed CEO for essentially the better part of the next decade until we merged AOL with Time Warner. And as part of that, I stepped aside as CEO. So it was one of the little bumps in the road on the entrepreneurial journey that I know is hard for people to relate to now, but I, you know, at the time there was some logic to it, even if I didn't really agree with it.
I think some of us at AOL wish you hadn't stepped aside again when you did. I think it was in 2002 when I was there. But I do want to ask you a question a little bit off topic, but on topic, because it relates to Rise of the Rest and people creating companies and entrepreneurship sort of gaining, I don't know, it feels like some momentum. I'm not that old, but old enough to know that it seems to go through waves. And in downturns of markets, it's in my career, it's always been one of the best times to start a company from the ground zero because you're already at zero. You're not coming down. But you mentioned that back when AOL went public, it was uncommon for a 30-year-old to be CEO, and Wall Street really didn't trust that. And that sort of gained a lot of media attention over the last two decades, that it's the young people. You hear VCs, even some VCs out there talking about, well, we're looking for the young people. But I find it ironic that when you start reading and digging into the data and you read the Inc. magazines on a regular basis and you read these magazines, you actually find that a lot of first-time entrepreneurs find themselves being able to do that in their 40s and 50s, and it's not too late. Can you comment a little bit on that and what you've seen in that?
Yeah, I think it's evolving. And I think in this next 10 or 20 years, the average age of a CEO probably will be higher. And the reason for that is we're moving into a era where it's not just about, you know, the coding and sort of a kind of more engineering centric kind of startups, which have tended to favor younger people, have fresh ideas and also have sometimes the deeper understanding of emerging, you know, technologies and trends. The reason I think it's starting to change is a lot of the really big opportunities for significant disruption, building significant, you know, companies are in sectors like healthcare and you know, other things like that, where technology, the coding, the software is obviously important, but it's kind of the table stakes. Where the real value is going to get created is in the partnerships you form around the technology, getting to work with, you know, major hospitals or health plans or what have you. And also how you regulate, you know, how you navigate sort of regulatory policy on some of these, you know, issues. A lot of these sectors, are regulated. And so if it's less about what you're building and more about the network you're building around the company and the partnerships you're forming to accelerate the growth of the company and the policies you're navigating to you know, be successful, that probably does make it more important to have people that have experience in those sectors and credibility in those sectors. So if they're, you know, they're pitching somebody at, say, the Mayo Clinic or Johns Hopkins, they're more likely to take it seriously because it's, you know, they're talking to somebody who they feel like they understand the healthcare sector. So there'll always be young entrepreneurs with new ideas and fresh thinking and challenging the status quo. And that will continue to, you know, be the case. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 10 or 20 years, as the innovation shifts to some of these sectors where, as I said, partnerships are more important and policy is more important, that there's somewhat older, wiser, you know, kind of better network kind of leaders that also emerge in a way that was less common in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. One of the things is, and this is sound crazy, but when I started my second company, I was in my late 30s or just maybe turned 40. And I actually was really discouraged because at the time the narrative was, well, if you're not in your 20s, the money people, which isn't always the answer because you can certainly bootstrap your company, and it was sort of deflating. I ignored it. Either I'm stubborn, crazy, or whatever you want to call it. But I think that knowing that you can do that and that it can be supported, and people like you who are thought leaders are saying, hey, it's not too late. So you don't hang up everything at 42 and resign yourself to working in a corporate career or working for someone else. You can make that change.
Yeah. And the other thing you're seeing more of, and you saw this certainly even in the last 10 years, are the younger founding CEOs bring on people with more expertise. This happened with Google when Eric Schmidt joined. It happened with Facebook when Sheryl Sandberg joined. It was a way to get the benefit of both that the perspectives that the founders, you know, Sergey and Larry on the Google side and Mark on the Facebook side brought, but also marrying that with some perspective that likely made it more probable that the companies would scale and fully capture the opportunity. So that's the other dynamic you'll probably see more of in the coming years.
Well, let's move on. We're going to fast forward, and I know it may sound strange, but some listeners probably don't remember AOL. Sometimes when I say I worked at AOL, and the people who worked at AOL still to this day, I was actually talking to a good friend this morning from AOL in marketing, always believed that was the best team they've ever been a part of to this day. And it was really a great experience. And I think it's worth listeners looking back at that history, because it's AOL still was one of the most innovative companies. And for a lot of reasons, that innovation got stifled. I can remember getting off at Dulles Toll Road onto Waxpole and having my AOL email, corporate email, read to me via voice in early 2000 and thinking to myself, we are so far ahead of the curve, because I was running numbers on our premium services at the time, and broadband specifically. And broadband just wasn't there to be able to deliver the experience at that time at scale to make the economics work. But we were so far ahead of our time that and some of those ideas, I actually think there's still some ideas in there that someone could take and actually still build a business in this third wave, if you will, of the internet, Steve. But I'm just saying that for listeners to go back, because there's a lot of things there that are great lessons. But 2002, 2003, you leave AOL, Time Warner. You have some things in your personal life that happen. And then you get this wild idea. I don't know where you got the energy after this 2+ decade run to start Revolution and really be, in my mind, having grown up in the Maryland, D.C. area, an anchor for new entrepreneurs to have a source of capital. And also, you become an advocate for entrepreneurship. Where did this, and I almost feel like, Steve, you're like just a patriot in the sense, coming from Hawaii. I think Hawaii became a state in your first birthday.
Right.
And you have this renewed, like, it's so refreshing that we have so much negativity in this country about, I don't want to say it's anti-American, but it's like, feel sorry for ourselves and all this stuff. And we still live in the greatest country in the world. And the fact that there people are even able to express that means that we live somewhere. So what happened when you left that you sort of got this, your second wave of energy to do this?
Well, it's kind of you say that. I was, when I stepped aside, I was around 40, so I wasn't quite ready to retire. I did start spending more time on philanthropy, although my wife, Jane, we already started the Case Foundation. She was really running that and leading that. So I was involved in that, but it wasn't going to be my primary focus. And I decided that it took me a couple of years, but rather than start another company, I would start a investment firm to back the next generation of companies, to support the next generation of entrepreneurs. And certainly part of that is, you know, writing checks as a venture capitalist, but also that was trying to be a mentor and leverage some of the expertise we have, some of the people we know in our network to help these companies, you know, scale. And then a few years later, it became even clearer that a real opportunity existed to be backing these companies all around the country. That at the time, 75% of venture capital was going to those three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. And we said, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, how do we find entrepreneurs in other places, back them in ways that have the potential to have even better returns, but also can have a positive impact on those communities? Because I saw some of the data around what was happening with new companies, startups, and the role they played in creating jobs in cities all around the country. And so, you know, that really accelerated when we launched the Rise of Rest bus tours 8 or 9 years ago. And then we launched a Rise of Rest seed fund about, you know, 5 years ago. And the main reason I decided to write the book on the Rise of Rest is after spending the better part of the decade traveling around the country, you know, visiting dozens and dozens and dozens of cities and meeting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of entrepreneurs, I was just struck by how many amazing things were happening, how many cities were kind of on the move, rising up as strong startup cities that most people had no clue what was going on. And so I just felt like it was a story that need to be told, in part because some of the companies were doing interesting things that I thought people should know about, in part because some of the cities, in fact, many of the cities, really dozens of cities, were really, you know, showing remarkable momentum around startups. But also, I did believe it, you know, from a national perspective, it was a way to help, at least in a small way, kind of knit together and bridge a big divide we have in this country, which is an opportunity gap where some people in some places are doing really well, and a lot of people, a lot of places are feeling kind of left out and left behind. So that's where it became even more of a mission to try to level the playing field, try to, you know, make sure everybody everywhere who has an idea has the ability to start and scale a company, and the communities they're in have, you know, can see the benefits of that in terms of more job growth, more economic growth.
Do you think that the pandemic has multiplied this or enhanced the idea that now we can work remotely? I remember talking to my board and believing back 15 years ago that we could work remote. And there was a lot of pushback of, you've got to be in the office. It has to happen that way. And I never understood that, Steve, because I think there was this thing called Linux that had 2,000 engineers that worked on through message boards and basically Sprint software. But we didn't have Jira back then, that built a modern day operating system and probably never met. But then the pandemic came and changed that ideas. And I'd also like you to comment on the traditional ways that venture capitalists really have thought about investing is the idea that we can get to that company within a few hours. If not, I live in Half Moon Bay for people listening, which is really a very rural town on the other side of the Santa Cruz Mountains. But in Silicon Valley, VCs wanted to be able to drive to the company. And when they said, where were you located? They meant what part of the peninsula,
right?
Because they wanted to figure out traffic. So do you think that the pandemic has changed that, or at least put a chink in the idea that, hey, you can invest in a company that's not necessarily around the DC beltway if you're in the DC area or something like that?
Yeah, no, it's definitely been sort of a tipping point in terms of the rise of the rest, because you saw momentum building in the last 10 years from when we first got started. Kind of every year we were making more progress. There are fewer skeptics around what's happening in these cities and more believers. And, you know, some people were starting to move to these cities or move back to these cities. Some people were starting to invest in these cities. But in the last 3 years, there's definitely been an acceleration. And as you know, the pandemic is a key part of that it was kind of a forcing function that suddenly everybody had to be on Zoom or other kind of video conferencing technologies because it was unsafe to be in the office. And suddenly, you know, people, even venture capitalists who before would do in-person pitch meetings were doing Zoom pitch meetings and said, well, if I'm doing a pitch meeting by Zoom, I guess they don't have to be just down the street. They could be somewhere else in the country. And so that has been, you know, helpful. It has led to an acceleration of the dispersion of talent, sometimes even the boomerang of talent, people returning, an acceleration of some of the coastal venture capital going to entrepreneurs in these different rise of the rest cities. So I do think we'll look back. Obviously, there are many tragic aspects of the pandemic, but one of the silver linings is what's happening in terms of the rise of the rest. There still are companies that believe they should be in person all the time. There are also some companies that are fully remote. Probably most companies have some version of hybrid where they're together some of the time, working separately, remotely, you know, much of the time. I think it'll take a number of years for it all to settle out. My guess is different companies, different entrepreneurs, and depending on what they're trying to do, what their stage is, and what some of the challenges and opportunities are, may adopt different strategies. But for sure, there's been an unlock and the sense that you can't really be in the major leagues and startup world if you're not in Silicon Valley. I think that sense has now diminished greatly. We kind of hit peak Silicon Valley probably 3 or 4 years ago, and it's still the lead of the pack. There's still obviously a lot of reasons to be there. There's still a lot of people there. There's still a lot of capital there, but it's not going to be the same in the next 10 or 20 years. I think you will see a more dispersion of innovation, more dispersion of capital, more dispersion of talent, more dispersion of the job creation that comes from new companies. I think that's long overdue and quite healthy.
Do you have any opinion on working remote back in the days when we all worked in AOL. It was in person. Remote wasn't even a discussion. We did, my experience back then was we got a lot of, and that I'm only referring to the AOL because that's my only real corporate, so to speak, experiences. I got a lot of work done, but I got distracted a lot. And do you have an opinion one way or the other on, does a hybrid model work? Does in, do you need to be in person all the time? And let's just put some edges really around tech, because if you're a scientist and you're doing healthcare and you're doing experiments, you're obviously going to have to be in a lab to do these things. Like, that's just not an option. But outside of that,
I think it varies. And we've now, with our Rise of Rest seed fund, backed 200 different companies in 100 different cities. And so quite a diverse mix of companies. And there are definitely some that have started as fully remote. And there are definitely some that are fully back in the office. They really do believe that that's the best way to drive innovation. And some of these Rise of the Rest, you know, cities, when there's not much of a commute time, that helps. You know, part of the pushback in the big superstar cities, New York City or San Francisco or others, is how much time people spend in the car commuting. If you can walk to work, or it's a 5 or 10 minute bike ride or drive or something, then, you know, people do seem to be more willing to be in the office and kind of like being in the office. So there is a correlation between commute time, how much time you feel like you're wasting stuck in traffic, and that drives some of your thinking. And, you know, I suspect most companies will be hybrid. There will be a lot of flexibility to work remotely, but at times either coming into the office or going to some place for an offsite where you can get that physical connection will also be important. So I think it's going to be very interesting to watch over the next decade. I don't think it's going to end up being a one size fits all. I don't think we'll go back to the days where almost all companies were in the office 5 days a week, but I also don't expect to go into a new world where most companies are fully remote. I think it will be some, for most companies, somewhere in the middle.
This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years experience in the real estate and lending space, and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know, because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. Now back to the show. Let's talk about a few of the stories. I'm interested in the ones that jump out to you from, for listeners, Rise of the Rest, Steve did and his company, 8 bus tours, 43 cities, 11,000 miles in the United States.
Right.
So you think about how many times you have to jump back through. There was a few of my favorites that I picked out. But are there, one was this Stored, I think it's pronounced Stored, they're out of Atlanta. And the reason it struck me, Steve, is because it's an example of how Kleiner, who has been an anchor in Silicon Valley venture capital for a long time, actually invested, I think they raised $50 or $70 million, 3,000 miles away from SFO Airport. And that starting to give, not just say something, but also give the people in these other cities hope that you actually can raise capital.
Yeah, I'd say one of the things that was a surprise to me, very encouraging, but a surprise to me, about a year ago, we did a joint report between our Rise of the Rest group and PitchBook. And one of the findings was, in the last decade, 1,400 new venture capital firms had started in these Rise of the Rest cities, outside of San Francisco, outside of New York, outside of Boston, 1,400. So there's far more capital in far more, you know, cities. Now, many of these are really early stage seed funds, venture funds, you know, still relatively modest in size, but they are able to provide that initial capital to get people started. And we co-invest with a lot of those folks. We've co-invested now with 300 regional venture firms to work with them to help identify promising companies and work with them to help them be successful. But as the companies start scaling and are beyond the seed stage, even beyond the venture stage, in that growth pre-IPO stage, and need to raise $50 million or $100 million, or in some cases even more, that's when it really is important to get the coastal investors to pay attention to it. And we have seen more of that happening in the last few years. And Stord in Atlanta is a good example of a city on the rise. They're focused on kind of logistics and have scaled up, you know, quite significantly. But Atlanta is also an aerospace hub. And one of the companies we also backed there called Hermias is building a Mach 5 engine. And so you can get from Atlanta to Europe in 90 minutes. And the Air Force is a big customer of theirs because obviously the Air Force likes to move things quickly. And that's another example of a company that's seeded with local capital, benefited from the connection with Georgia Tech, one of the great research universities that's sort of in their backyard. And as they scaled up, they too have now raised upwards of $100 million, including from some, you know, coastal funds, Founders Fund, Coastal and others. So you are seeing more and more of the Silicon Valley investors who, as you said earlier, historically were just investing in their own backyard, not really looking at other places, starting to explore other parts of the country. And that clearly is going to accelerate over this next decade.
Do you remember a company of all places in Omaha called LifeLoop?
Right.
They were an app. Maybe you could talk a little bit about them, only because it's Omaha. I think of Warren Buffett when I think of Omaha, but you don't think Warren is investing right there mainly because he doesn't do the small amount of investments. But that struck me as that's a place you just wouldn't think where you could build an app.
Yeah, well, but that, I would say that's the story of the rise of the rest. We've now visited nearly 50 cities by bus. We've invested in 100 different cities, and most of the cities surprise people. They really had no idea that there were startups in Omaha or Indianapolis or Detroit or Des Moines or Chattanooga or the dozens of other cities. In fact, the hardest part about writing the book was culling it because we only didn't want the book to be too long. We ended up profiling about 30 different cities, about 40 different companies. We could have kept going because this really is such a widespread phenomenon. But specifically around LifeLoop, they were the winner of our pitch competition in Omaha. The founder, Amy, would basically identify this problem because trying to keep track of what's happening with seniors who are in retirement homes or somehow getting healthcare from other providers was very disorganized. So basically created, you know, software to allow you to do that more effectively. And that's, she's gone on to merge that with another company and it's really starting to scale up. And it's in Omaha, which is, you know, has not had a new Fortune 500 company launched there in 100 years. And so it kind of needs a new act, and companies like LifeLoop are providing more of that visibility. I also mentioned Chattanooga, really interesting city, 10 years ago had the fastest broadband in the country. Nobody would ever think that Chattanooga would have faster broadband than San Francisco or New York, but it did. The mayor there took the lead in building out the fiber capability, and that's unleashed a lot of startup activity, including one of the companies we backed called FreightWaves has been building a Bloomberg-like data platform for the trucking industry. And some of the biggest trucking companies in America are headquartered in Chattanooga. So if you're building kind of Bloomberg for trucking, better to be in Chattanooga than in New York. Another story I love is actually a founder, Carter Malloy, who was in San Francisco at the time, working for a hedge fund at the time, and came up with the idea for a company called AcreTrader, which is an investment platform to allow people to invest in farmland. He said, well, I'm going to be successful with this company. I need to get the farmers to trust me. I need to get the farmers to put their land on my platform so people could invest in those properties. And so he moved to Fayetteville, Arkansas, and has launched that company there, scaled that company there. They've also gone on to raise a significant amount of venture capital, have about 150 employees now in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Most people wouldn't think that Fayetteville is a startup city. So these are just some of the stories we've had the opportunity to see, some of the companies we've had the opportunity to invest in. And that really led to writing the book because, just as you were saying, you didn't expect to see LifeLoop in Omaha. We didn't expect to see most of these companies in most of these cities. And it's a story that needed to be told that hasn't really been told.
Yeah, it's definitely, when I went through the book, thinking like how hard it must be and how that entrepreneur must feel to not just be in the middle and not have in the middle of a country and not have the ecosystem around it. But the idea that this can happen also has, it's not ancillary, but there are ancillary effects to it. One being the jobs that these places see as being taken away because of technology.
Right.
I mean, the first thing, one day I landed at SFO, Steve, and I saw the robot coffee shop. And I stood there, this is just a few years ago, staring at this thing for, I think my wife was out front honking the horn, but like 20 minutes thinking the barista is over. It's over. And what does that mean? What are the implications of that? So one is, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. And secondly, which isn't mentioned, and I'm going to take the opportunity to mention it because I believe it is really important, is by diversifying technology throughout the United States and innovation, if we as the United States want to remain the innovation leader in as a country, we are going to need to think strategically, because by aggregating all of our technology in effectively driven by venture capital, which these companies need, into three states, our adversaries are able to infiltrate, and I hesitate to use the word steal, but take technology and bring it back. And this isn't talked about enough in my mind, but having had some experience in this, it is a real threat to America. And this is not top secret classified stuff. You can read it in the news if you go back and look at FBI reports and people who have been arrested from foreign nations who are infiltrating these technology companies and literally taking that technology back to these countries, replicating it, and just by mere force and capital that these countries are throwing at it, leapfrog in some cases, scary enough. And TikTok may be an example of that, that it is a real threat to our country. So I don't know if you've thought about that, but definitely the jobs, and to me, diversifying technology so that we do not have this three honeypots of places is really important.
Yeah, no, I think right now we do have the most innovative entrepreneurial nation in the world, which is great. But there is risk that we might lose that lead, you know, China in particular, but other countries have stepped up. And you've seen this, if you track global venture capital, 3 decades ago, over 90% of global venture capital was invested in the United States. Now it's under 50%. So clearly other people are trying to kind of lead in sort of the technology of the future and in the industries of the future. So I think the best way to maximize the likelihood of continuing to lead is to make the investments necessary. I was encouraged by some of the congressional legislation in the last 6 months, including the CHIPS and Science Act, which passed with bipartisan support to try to bring semiconductor manufacturing back to the United States. We're less reliant on Taiwan, and also has authorized about $10 billion of funding for regional hubs to accelerate what's happening with the rise of the rest. So I think that is important kind of steps forward. I think we need to maximize our shots on goal, trying more different things, different entrepreneurs doing different things, different sectors, different places that maximize the likelihood that we'll continue to lead the way.
I know we only have you for a short time here. Could you talk a little bit as we start to wrap up about the four big trends that you talk about that are actually happening? You mentioned this in The Rise of the Rest, and I'd like you to comment a little bit on them, because most of the things that you've predicted have happened and you've seen these trends. So,
yeah, there's a number of things that are happening individually, but are now starting to converge. And as they converge, there's going to be an acceleration of what's happening in some of those sectors. And we've talked a little bit about some of it, what's happening with regional entrepreneurship, what's happening around, you know, venture capital spreading somewhat more broadly, talent spreading more broadly. That creates a significant opportunity. Another mega trend is some of these sectors really benefiting from partnerships, and that ties in with this regional distribution, as we talked about before. Some of those partnerships can really be big accelerants. There's also, again, we've talked a bit about this, what's happening on the government side, that ultimately it's the entrepreneurs starting the companies and the investors backing the companies, but there also is a role for government and some of the national priorities around some of the legislation that's passed, like the CHIPS and Science Act, also the Inflation Reduction Act, which has a lot of investment in sustainability, is helpful as well. So there are a number of things that are building that I think are really interesting to watch as individual paths. But what's most exciting is how they're starting to converge and accelerate, which I think unleashes a new wave of innovation that will be much more dispersed all around the country, attacking some of the most important aspects of our lives, reimagining what's possible in those areas, and doing it in partnership with companies, organizations that can accelerate growth, and in many cases also with alliance, with collaboration with government, setting sort of the rules of the world, not just in this country, but also around the world.
So with that, I could open up. I've got a whole list of questions for you that would take 4 more hours. And I'm sure you could talk about all of these great stories and all of these things happening in our country and with entrepreneurship. And now I think is never been a better time to start a company. Could you comment a little bit on that? Do you believe that you didn't necessarily start AOL in a downturn? It was like a no turn for technology, although the Apple computer was making a rise and IBM and Microsoft even back then. But in my career, and if you look at a lot of companies in the, I guess it's really, I don't know how to keep track of this anymore, Steve, like was AOL in 85.0, and then we went to 1.0 in the 90s, maybe 2.0 in the 2000s, maybe we're in 3 or 4.0, depending on how you keep track of it. But do you think that it is a good time to start a company in a downturn, mainly because you really are at zero and you can come out of these downturns with momentum?
Yeah, no, it's a great time to start. That's not to say it's not challenging for entrepreneurs to raise capital. It is getting easier, particularly in these rise and rest cities for the reason I mentioned earlier. But if you do have an idea, now's a great time to start, in part because some of the big companies you're likely challenging are starting to play defense. When the economy turns, they tend to cut back on innovation, cut back on investments in the future. So it actually creates more of an opening, more of a vacuum for entrepreneurs to pounce. And so part of the message of the book is, if you do have an idea, now's the time to put that into action. And you shouldn't feel like you have to move to a place like Silicon Valley in order to do that. Now you really can do that anywhere. So I'm hoping that people, you know, reading the book, some might be inspired to take that next step, and having identified some problem they want to solve, actually build a company around that and do it now from wherever they happen to live.
So through 4 decades of working, starting companies, investing in companies, someone asks you for 3 pieces. You can only give someone 3 pieces of advice for listeners, entrepreneurs, business people aspiring to be entrepreneurs or even in business and looking to scale, which has its own challenges. I don't think we talk enough about. It's almost like you're a startup in a startup when you go from startup to quote unquote mature company. What would those 3, we call them HPTs, high percentage tips, be?
Well, I think I'd probably point to 3 things I learned, the three lessons I learned, 3 quotes that have inspired me. One is around execution. It's from Thomas Edison more than a century ago, who said, "Vision without execution is hallucination." So yes, it's important to have a big idea. Yes, it's important to have a vision of how things are going to change and how you're going to be positioned to drive some of that change. But it really comes down to the execution and the team you build and the priorities you set. So that Thomas Edison quote about execution, I've always loved. There's another one, which is an African proverb that really talks about the importance of partnerships and alliances. It says, if you want to go quickly, you can go alone, but if you want to go far, you must go together. I believe the era we're in now, it's going to require partnerships, because systems level change is really required in financial services, in food and agriculture, in healthcare. And so alliances are going to really allow you to achieve things that you couldn't do on your own. So that African proverb, I think, is important. And the third one is really around perseverance. I had the opportunity a number of years ago to meet Nelson Mandela. One of the things he is famous for as a quote is, "It always seems impossible until it happens. It seems elusive." You know, that battle you're trying to fight, that mountain you're trying to climb, suddenly looks like it's impossible. But if you stick with it, if you persevere, and you have a team that joins you on that, because obviously entrepreneurship is a team sport, eventually you can break through. I saw that in the early days with the internet, with AOL, as we talked about, it was 10 years of a slog. And finally, you know, the momentum started building. More recently, I've seen that with the Rise Breast. When we started 10 years ago, most people were pretty skeptical about the idea of entrepreneurs in different cities around the country. Now there's more of a sense that that's possible and likely even more and more probable. I think this next decade, there really will be an acceleration. So those are some of the quotes that have inspired me, some of the ideas that have inspired me that might be helpful to others.
Well, thanks for those. Those are great. For listeners, Steve's new book is The Rise of the Rest, How Entrepreneurs in Surprising Places Are Building the New American Dream. We'll put a link so that you can grab this book. I encourage everybody to read it. It's a great read. It's not a super long read, and it will inspire and give you some information on how Steve started AOL and his early days. Steve, thanks a ton for being on the show and sharing everything.
Thanks, Brandon. It's been great to be with you.
Bye, everyone.